When you've only seen one game, so it must be the best game in history. It's That's So MLS, a North American soccer podcast with myself, Andrew Bates, and Nick Thornton.
It's me.
You can find us on iTunes. Please rate, review, subscribe, or at thatsomls.com. Nick, was that... everybody was... I feel like as a story, you couldn't have asked for a better introduction to Zlatan Ibrahimovic's time in MLS.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Columbus-Vancouver for a second. Right, okay, yeah, the other game.
Oh, yeah. Was it a little... Did people get a little too carried away, though?
In MLS?
Or was it the right amount of carried away?
I guess... Well, I mean, who are we talking about here? Who's getting too carried away? Because that'll help me narrow down what I think of the reactions.
I can't remember the first person that I saw that said that this might be the best MLS game ever. I want to say that it was an MLS video game. Or SI tweet.
It was like an official source.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it described elsewhere as like, you know, something that was crazy for 90 whole minutes. And I don't want to undersell it. Because it was great, but I really think it was a great 30 minutes. Like,
yeah. To call it the greatest game in MLS is stupid. It's short-sighted.
The best
is patently wrong. And that doesn't.
It was a great game.
Don't being spectacular.
Yes, I think the best game in MLS history is the. The Eastern Conference final between Toronto and Montreal in 2016.
Mm.
First leg. The one that had seven goals.
Right.
This also had seven goals, but it's the stakes are way different. And also, like, for three quarters of the... And maybe this is what makes the introduction that people were baying for of Zlatan so important, is that... For the first two-thirds of that game, those were the exact... The teams were doing exactly what we had expected of them all season.
Mm-hmm. I'll say this. It was the best LAFC versus LA Galaxy game in MLS history. Bar none.
It should be interesting. I mean, like, this is... Like, if you think back to Chivas USA, they tried very hard to push that rivalry...
Mm-hmm.
When they had those two teams, and I think that this is going to be more interesting. I think that there is a legitimate difference in philosophy between the two teams, which creates a great rivalry because you have a team in LAFC that I think is still a little bit more comprehensive and is based more on Latin American talent, whereas the Galaxy have always had that kind of Galacticos approach.
Yeah.
Not that they haven't had Mexican stars, obviously. They've got Tito Santos, but, like, the identity's a little different.
Absolutely. And, I mean, it was a total wonder strike. The 40-yard out volley. But again, I think it's sort of a case of short memories. We have seen goals like that in MLS before. Maybe with that kind of pure class and just ease, maybe not. Zlatan is one of the greats. We know that. The second goal looked pretty offside as well. Just because he got himself out of the play. I think there's still an argument to be made that play should have been called dead.
Right. Because it was kind of like there was the two touches, and on the first touch it was definitely 100% offside. And then he drifted into a position where it could be maybe photo finish. I still think he was kind of a little bit offside.
I think so, because he's running to play the ball, and just because he pulls off of it, when the ball is played, he is offside, looking to play the ball. I mean, that being said, I get the reason why the call was made, but... I think you at least have to agree that there's some contention there. But I agree. This really, to me, was a game that was played in 30 minutes. I mean, Vela also had a wonder strike early on into the match.
Yeah.
LAFC looked fantastic for much of it, and then they were able to switch gears. But for me, what I saw with LAFC was not a, oh no, Ibrahimovic is on, what do? We can't play anymore. It was that they switched off a little bit mentally, and we saw a team that has only played a few matches, which I think it's easy to forget, and is still finding their feet.
Yep.
And just made a few mistakes. The Zlatan goal, there was nothing they could have done about that. But the other two goals, I thought, were kind of soft and unfortunate for LAFC to give them up. So it was a certainly exciting game, but I struggle to call any game of soccer great that ends in seven goals, because, again, that still says to me probably at least five of those goals were preventable. If there's seven goals that are scorpion kicks and bicycle kicks and just highlight real stuff, then maybe. But again, as a defender, I like to see a team that can hold a lead for 60 minutes and not just trade goals back and forth, even though it's a great come-from-behind story, etc. MLS loves this kind of thing, and they love this sort of splashy story that really doesn't tell you a lot beyond one team beat the other team in the end of the day.
I admit that because I was on the road, I didn't get to see it live, and I feel like the intrigue of it might have been a little bit more live.
Sure.
And like even more than just the actions on the pitch, you do have to say that for the first meeting between the two teams, for the debut of Zlatan and the two goals, it does definitely, the context definitely elevates the game.
Absolutely.
It started really rough for the Galaxy. Ibrahimovic was on the bench. Vela had his wonder strike early. I was watching that first half thinking, Vela is really good. The Galaxy keeper Bingham is not that good.
No, I honestly thought that too. Is that on a couple of those goals from LAFC, Bingham just looked terrible, just so out of place and really leaving himself in a lot of trouble a couple of times.
On the second one, it was a great move from Vela to be able, like, it was very precise to get it in off the crossbar and in.
Yeah.
But just before that, he kind of gets a weird rebound off Bingham, and the positioning is so bad of LA's the Galaxy defenders that Vela turns around for what feels like 2 hours. Like, it feels,
I noticed that too. That play, he's just like, and it's not to say he's slow, but it's just like he had so much time. And then off the crossbar, there's four LA Galaxy defenders lined up on the line. So credit to Vela for beating all four, but they're all just sort of stood there and nobody's putting pressure on Vela. So it's like, well, why do you need four guys on the line if no one's going to actually put pressure on the striker? He's just got to aim it where you're not. And you're not going to be able to react quick enough at that close of an angle. And Bingham just gets so caught out and sort of flops over and makes the wrong decision. But none of his defenders are there to bail him out. So beyond standing on the back line.
The other thing I thought, too, was that we kind of, in our discussion of, like, is VAR good or bad? Or is that, like, how is it being used or misused? I had with that goal really real flashbacks to the, I want to say the 2010 World Cup no goal that Frank Lampard didn't score. But kind of did score. I'm trying to remember if that was. I think the 2010 is right. One of the nice things about VAR is that, you know, nobody made that mistake this time of not doing it. But even though there didn't have to be a video review, I felt a lot safer because there was so much other so much else going on in this match in terms of story that a soft disallowed, like such a terrible disallowed goal really would have changed the mood and and ruined a great match in MLS history, as we've heard. The roller coaster, it did definitely once. LA was able to score, I want to say, on like 55 or something, with a great ball. The goal from Letget was great, but the ball from Carrasco, I really thought was super.
That was
good.
A pretty tasty pass, and that's the other thing is that I feel like the unfortunate part here, the part that's overlooked, is LA Galaxy's ability to get back into the match even before Ibrahimovic comes on the pitch. Because if they're not able to do that, I mean, it helps to know you've got Ibrahimovic on the bench. But so he comes in and scores two goals, and they lose 3-2. So I'd say credit to LA Galaxy for getting stuck in and sort of finding something that they haven't seemed to have been able to tap into in their opening matches and grind out some goals. Again,
this is not to say that they weren't. They were a little hapless on defense, and that own goal was a real example of that. That created the 3-goal lead.
But the own goal, I was like, you've seen every team in MLS make that mistake at some point. Like, he is trying to cross it.
Including Vancouver, not 1 week before.
Yeah, exactly. So it is bad, but I don't think there's a team in MLS that's immune to own goals.
On the second LA goal, I can't just call them LA, there's two of them. On the second Galaxy goal, you got an idea of the player Ibrahimovic is off the ball, where he's kind of a poacher, he's kind of wandering around, seeing if he can get into trouble. But he didn't at that time seem to be causing as much. Because he sort of sends in the cross that's cleared badly, so I guess that's good. Mm-hmm. But he's sort of off doing his own thing a little bit, it feels like, on that second goal. This, of course, really plays off well in the last two goals, in the first goal he scored, but that was my read on that first one.
Yeah, I think, I mean, much has been written about the player that he is, but he's just so good off the ball and drifts into those spaces and runs intelligently that that is where he is dangerous, is that he's easy to forget about because he can just sort of meander around for a little bit and he doesn't look like he's much of a threat. But if you're taking a sort of poor-headed clearance and volleying it from 40 yards away, just because you're in the right position and you're paying attention to everything that's going on around you, it's his awareness as much as his movement that will get him goals this season, to say nothing of his athleticism and his just sheer talent as a striker. I think that is where defenses and defensive midfielders are going to struggle against him, is that he's just going to drift wherever he wants to go. And he's going to be a very difficult player to consistently mark the way that he plays. A lot of MLS sides aren't really set up to defend a player like him. And not just because of his talent, but because of the way that he drifts.
And this is his first goal was just picture perfect. I love that the call on commentary was, "Oh, come on, come on!"
Pretty specific.
What's beautiful about it? So the whole thing is great. The timing is wonderful. The strength and power on a strike that far away is phenomenal. Where I love it, soccer is obviously every team is trying to score all the time, and not all attempts work, but you want to believe that they do. And some people have the ability to just decide, this is what I'm scoring now.
Yeah.
Even though the whole game is based on making it that you can't just decide to do that. The look on his face and the attention that he has as the ball comes and makes its first contact so that he is like, he has got his physics board in his mind already, like drawing up the half volley, like velocity ratio.
Yeah.
But he already knows at this point when it's still in the, before it even touches the ground, that he could do something with this.
Absolutely. And I think some of the naivety of MLS, some MLS fans and commentators is, this is not the first time he's done this. Like, it's the first time he's done it in MLS, but we've seen him do this at every club he's been at. He's capable of scoring those kinds of goals. This certainly is not the first, and it probably won't be the last 40-yard volley that he scores. It's maybe not his preferred way of scoring goals, but he can do it. It was an interesting match. I sort of took a little bit of issue that during another match they had to switch back and forth so much to that.
And which match was that, by the way?
some two teams that we don't follow. I did like, honestly, I think the star of the match is the El Trafico moniker for the LA Derby. I thought that was excellent.
I like and that. The pun is so great because when LAFC was up 3-0, the commentators were calling it one-way Trafico.
Yeah, yeah. There's so much you can do with that one. Very clever. but on the other side of things, we also had another 7-goal game this weekend. Orlando and New York Red Bulls, and everything just sort of not quite going New York's way, despite scoring 3 goals.
You texted me that you were like, let's talk. It's gonna be another defense criticism corner.
It was like for two of the first games of the afternoon, and there's 14 goals between two games.
Yes,
somebody's defense messed up.
And even we'll talk more about some of the other games later. But it was a goalful weekend.
Yeah, and I mean the interesting thing is that for much of this match, New York Red Bulls was without Wright Phillips, which seemed to hamper them a little bit. In 7 minutes in, Velotte, is that his name? Florian Velotte gets the
yes.
Kicks things off, and then a few minutes later, Will Johnson levels. A few minutes after that, Etienne Jr. gets another one back. 2 minutes after that, Dom Dwyer gets one back. So for the first 25, 26 minutes of this game, again, 26 minutes in, it's 2-2. And a lot of this, I wouldn't say any of those goals were particularly great. It was really poor defending from both sides that saw this happen. Rather than break down every single thing, to me there were sort of two highlights from this game, which was A, Dom Dwyer getting the brace and being Dom Dwyer that we've sort of missed as of late, and seeing Justin Merrim and Sasha Clustin on the pitch together, working well together, and doing so well. And this is a thing that we talked about in preseason of those two signings and how influential they'd be. We finally sort of saw that change the tide in this game.
Absolutely. The other thing that I wanted to point out, because you mentioned Johnson and the idea of poor defense, is that we talked so much about this Zlatan wonder goal, but I think the offensive move of the weekend was Johnson teleporting into the middle of the New York goal area, unmarked, no one around him, just standing there. How did he get there? How did they allow that to happen?
Yeah, that was just bananas. I'm just trying to bring up the goal again to refresh my memory, but I do recall. You're just like, what, is anybody? Is any? No, is any? Okay. Oh, well, that's going to happen. It's in.
Yeah, like the ball.
Now. Yeah, he's just like, there's nobody there. It's incredible.
There's a lot of ball watching this weekend, I feel, but
yeah.
especially in this case, it's like It's like he had set up a little picnic in there.
I think.
How did he get there?
What you don't see off frame is his little folding chair that he sort of put back on the sideline. Sorry. I gotta go. I think a ball's coming through into the box there. It was really, really poor defending from New York Red Bulls, and I just wonder, perhaps, if we're seeing a little bit of lack of focus because they're currently playing Guadalajara and in Champions League action. But I would say this for a 7-goal game, the real takeaway from this one is that both teams were just very switched off defensively. However, yep. Orlando, finally all the pieces clicked that we saw what they're capable of when things are going right, at least in the offensive half. We finally saw some of the power behind that, and I expect that this is going to be not the first high-scoring game that we'll see from Orlando. Their task now is to tighten things up at the back, where defensively they continue to struggle, and they didn't really add too many reinforcements in the offseason. They did ship people out.
No.
But I think it's arguably their back line has not improved drastically.
I would the one thing that I kind of want to be a little hard on, because I know that you were talking up Dom Dwyer. I do have a problem with both of those goals, and maybe one of it's just me, but there was a concern in that first one. The goalkeeper was immediately thought that he had been fouled, and I kind of agreed with him. Dwyer kind of backed up on him into the net, and like. He was able to head it in, but he was able to head it in because he was sitting on the goalkeeper's lap.
Wait, so that's not allowed?
Well, I mean, like, if everybody's okay with it, I guess. But Robles seemed pretty mad about it.
a little bit.
The other issue that I had is that... this is a rules-based question that I might just be wrong about. Can you be offside on a throw-in?
I have no idea.
Like, because in my opinion, Dwyer is very offside at the time. Like, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just the way a throw-in works. You can stay wherever you want because it's throw-in, long throws, and all that, but he really seems to be behind the last defender. I could be wrong, but that was my analysis of those two. Which, mm-hmm. I mean, like, on another way to look at that is to say that he's being, like, the Dom Dwyer of old that you refer to is irrepressible. And so, unfortunately, I would kind of, you know, pick apart those two things, whether or not they were legal. But...
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I think there's a point to be made. You know, the other part of it, though, is what we have seen from New York Red Bulls is again, an awful lot of ball watching. And I agree, there certainly seems a bit of a shove from Dwyer into Robles there, that he does end up kind of sitting on him. That being said, I don't know. It's difficult. I need to look up more about the rules of fouling goalkeepers, but... You know, Dom Dwyer is not a big player, neither is Robles, but I think he just needs to stand him up a little bit more. And to me, Robles just kind of gets backed into the net, but it doesn't really look like a push. And, like, sometimes you've kind of got to hold your position, whether it's interference or a foul or not. I'm not sure. And there's not a clear angle that I've seen anyway that shows that. But I see your point.
There's also an amazing, just to the point of the offenses being switched off, there was a great chance from substitute Chris Mueller for Orlando that I thought was onside, but like is just another example of like, how is he allowed to take that? Who let him do that?
Yeah.
who let him get in that position?
That's where I have a bit of a hard time with the naysayers of the late calls are looking purely at the call, because it's like, well, first of all, as you said, why is he even allowed in that position? Like, let's analyze both sides of it here.
It was legal. That one was legal, but it was like, it was still It was still mind-blowing just that it happened.
Yeah. Looking around the league, some interesting results. One of the teams that we had said was looking up last week and got a big, big win this weekend was New England.
Who came That's in right, Houston, yeah.
And just sort of somehow did everything right. Houston looked tired and really not switched on either, but credit to New England for pouncing on it and getting a massive away win, considering also they soaked up a tremendous amount of pressure, especially in the last 10 minutes or so. That this was the first game where Houston, I think, had a bit of misfortune, but New England actually looked defensively quite good. And I was quite impressed for them to get a 2-0 away win in Houston. And might be a little bit troubling for some Houston fans, given that the Compass Stadium has been such a stronghold. And I believe that's 2 in a row now that they've lost at home. Or 2 this season.
I also wanted to just say that I loved... When I think of the Houston, as I detail on the program before, when I think of the Houston New England match, I think of the it's a rematch of both the 2006 and 2007 MLS Cup Finals, which were very key to me. So I always love seeing this. I always love seeing this match. It is kind of a factor. It shows how. Perhaps a little bit less than last year, when I think they were more, when they were a little bit more integrated as a squad. Mm-hmm. Would you say that Houston is now a little bit more reliant on Elise?
Yes. In a word, yes. I still think they're a really, really, really great squad, and I think that her pace is still serving them well. And this game wasn't without chances. I think there's just a few kind of missed opportunities that another night, another game would have gone in, and maybe it's 2-1 or 2-2. But, yeah, I think there's a case to be made for them just lacking a little bit of team chemistry and focus. Again, they looked sort of lethargic, and their midfield was just not stepping up and putting pressure on. And, you know, again, we've said New England is a good team. They just haven't been getting the results, and they keep making mistakes, primarily having players sent off. But, you know, the first goal, Bunbury's just sort of like walking into the 18-yard box, and then just sort of nobody really properly picks him up.
In contrast to the last couple of games the last game where offside was... an issue, and as it has been around the league this weekend, I thought that goal was a really great, like the opposite of an offside trap. Like it was a great exploiting of the idea of offside. New England were able to handle it very well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Bunbury, I've been giving him a little bit of shtick over the last couple of weeks for just not being fully switched on. This is a great example of just sitting in the pocket between those two defenders and just reading the play exactly correctly and being patient, not going too soon. Part of the reason why he's able to be patient and not get called offside is because the two defenders just, they see him, but they're not really doing anything about him. And for some reason, they think he's not a threat and he's not going to get the ball. And it's just a perfectly timed ball in that he's basically able to just stride forward and knock it in easily.
Mm-hmm. So you think that maybe, like, as much as it was good, he wasn't dialed in prior to the play? I'm just trying to get your read on Bunbury was in that situation. Do you think that he was super dialed in, or do you think that he was kind of drifting before that?
Yes. No, sorry. I thought he was very dialed in. I thought the defenders weren't in letting him drift in so much because he made it look so effortless. It's great timing from him, but it's easy to have that kind of, well, not easy. It's easier to have that kind of timing if no defender is putting pressure on you. And it sort of seems like he's the obvious choice to receive the ball in the box.
So, yes. You're a defender. DeMarcus Beasley is a defender and has been for a long time. We know that he's a a great player.
Yeah.
Did he make the right choice in committing the foul to and getting himself sent off to avoid that goal?
It's very hard to say because in that situation, there's not a lot you can do. It's a very clear foul. I don't think there's much argument there. It's a technical foul.
I have written down in my notes, I don't know what his complaint is.
Yeah, and I don't, like, whatever. I allow any home fan base to get as upset as they want to any red card, regardless of how egregious it is. That's your prerogative as a home fan and part of trying to energize your team. But I'll say this. If it was the 80th minute and it was 1-0 and your team was having the kinds of chances that Houston were having in the 80th minute, albeit with 10 men, then I think you need to take that risk. When the play happened, it was so early on into the game, I think you need to, like, try to get in front of the striker and hold him up a little bit with your body. Because if you do that, you're going to draw a foul and a free kick. Maybe a yellow for playing the player and not the ball. But to drag him down from behind, you're always going to risk a red.
Yeah.
And DeBeasley's been, he's been in this season, in this league for long enough and enough seasons to know that's a very good chance of a red card. And I think it's a fair sending off on denying a clear goal-scoring opportunity. If anything, he's lucky that it didn't happen a second later because then he would have been in the box and it would have been a penalty as well.
Yeah.
I think it was a bit of a rush of blood to the head, but if I'm a defender in that situation and I'm behind the play, I'm going to try to make some attempt to cut down the angle and make it difficult for the player to pull off the shot rather than go for the technical foul that close to the box, especially at that point in the game. If I'm chasing Giovinco in the 80th minute, I'm going to drag that little bastard down. But
yeah, I think that you're definitely right in saying that with the earliness in the game was a problem, especially when players like Teal Bunbury are drifting around so effortlessly, the last thing you want to do is provide them with more space.
Yeah, and ultimately I think that Houston might have done better and gotten something more out of this with a full 11 players. And if anything, New England had to really readapt to playing against 10 men and then seemed to struggle after it. In a sort of classic, it's harder to defend 10 than 11 scenario. You know, it's a silly play too because now he's missing the next match as well. And he's been such a key piece of their defense. So, you know.
Straight red knows, as well.
Yeah, he knows what he's risking in that moment. I'm just looking to see who they are playing next. And it is the second straight loss at home because they lost to the Whitecaps 2 weeks prior to that at home.
Pew pew.
Their next game is away at San Jose. So, yeah. It's unfortunate.
Yeah. I thought that Seitz had a great game for Houston, and that's a plus. The other thing I wanted to point out was Christian Pineas, the step over to leave his defender in the dust.
Oh, that for me was actually
fine. Finish was great.
That's my play of the week. I thought, you know, watching the Houston defender overstep. But he really just makes a total mockery out of him and then just slams it into the top corner. I thought was really, really crafty and great to see in a team like New England that's been kind of anemic on the goal scoring front. That's the kind of initiative you need to just pull something out of nothing, regardless of whether you're being defended well or not. That's all him that creates that goal. And it's great to see New England have something else in their back pocket to pull out, because as we know, in as the league wears on and you're doing tough road games, if you're able to pull one of those out, well, you know, that makes a boring 0-0 draw into a 1-0 victory and a big 3 points away. So I kind of laughed when that happened. It's happened. I've been on the receiving end of that play any number of times, but I still just went, all right, well done you.
Some weeks with this team, like, sometimes they don't seem like they have anything going. In some weeks when they have Teal Bunbury going so well, we didn't see as much from Diego Fagundes this game as we have in past games.
Mm-hmm.
But to see, you know that he's there. You know that Christian Pinillo is doing great runs. You see that amazing, that almost amazing free kick from Claude Dielna, which itself, if you're talking about great plays and great free kicks as you sometimes do with Javinko, if that would have gone in, it would have been incredibly memorable. You know, if
absolutely, if wishes were vicious. And it's good to see Delamea. You know, he's struggled at times, but or Dielna rather, not Dielma. Two different players.
Delamea,
same team.
Maybe sounds correct.
Dielna. Right, he's made some silly calls, and I think he's struggled a little bit in the league at times, but that was great to see. The other thing to remember, too, is that this is a team that, another team that we said didn't do much in the offseason, and right now, to pull off that kind of performance, they're also still doing it without two of their best players. One of their best players departed to the Vancouver Whitecaps, of course. Lee Wynn is still there and hasn't played a minute because they don't need him. And, you know,
he's not even dressed.
No, and I genuinely have some empathy for his situation. But boy, is he ever in a pickle now. I don't expect he'll play again until the summer, unless there's some major injuries. But why would you?
I don't know who would take him outside of it. The MLS window is closed. And if you're not playing, I imagine you're not going to Europe.
Well, and that's precisely the thing. I think in the thing that him or his agent miscalculated is that to try to force a move, now he's stuck in no man's land where, mm-hmm. exactly as you said, why would a team in Europe pick him up? I would expect perhaps the rumors surrounding the Vietnamese clubs might pick up again, but he could be going for a lot less than he'd originally planned because he's not playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine, too, because of the bad blood, we don't know what his training is like. So, and he's got to keep up his fitness as well.
This is an issue for him that maybe some other people wouldn't necessarily have, some other players, that because of the way that he exited Vancouver and the way that he is currently not exiting but has exited New England, I don't know that he has, like, a huge network of people that are, you know, I don't know that he has somebody he could call in Mexico to be like, hey,
yeah,
do you need anybody down there?
Which is unfortunate because I think he is genuinely, on his day, one of the best midfielders in the league. And we've seen what he can do. He's never had quite the combination of players around him. I'm still a little bit surprised that perhaps Orlando didn't pick him up, but when they got Kleshtin and Merrim, you kind of go, well, okay, well, yeah, they're just as good. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting to see. Another team that got a sort of surprise victory out of things was our dear old Colorado Rapids. What did you make of their 3-0 win over what has been so far a very, very defensively sound Philadelphia?
Okay, so we were talking about a lot of goals, and I thought that the natural counterbalance to 2 7-goal games would be a Colorado-Philadelphia 0-0 draw. It seemed like that's just how the world works. And after, like, when you watch the highlights of that game, no, I did not watch it live with those two teams involved. When you watch the highlights of that game, and there's, like, a grand total of 15 seconds of footage from the first half.
Yeah.
With maybe one good play. It's like, well, oops. I guess this is going to be that game. But if you would have... The level of predicting ability that I would be able to have to say Dominic Badgey gets a second half hat trick.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't do it. I would never have said that would happen.
Absolutely not. And well done to him. Another performance that I think will be overlooked this weekend, unfortunately, because of the other high-profile goals and storylines. And I know Philadelphia and Colorado isn't exactly the sexiest MLS headlining game. But I was really excited. I love Dominic Badji. I think he's a great, just out-and-out, classic MLS striker. And that means that a lot of games, you watch him kind of huff and puff and nothing happens. But this was a great, great result from Colorado. Not just because they finally won a game and they scored more than one goal. But because
Tim Howard gets a clean sheet.
And I got to say, there's points where we know what kind of threat CJ Sapong can be in Philadelphia can be. And I thought that Colorado actually looked one of the better defensive sides this weekend. Not just for Colorado, but across the league. They just seem to be finally a little bit more composed and playing together. And that's the one thing I'll say for the Rapids, is they do seem to have great team chemistry and an ability to really want to play for each other. And, you know, especially considering the past couple of seasons they've had and how rough things have been, they've maintained faith in a bunch of core players, and those players are starting to give back. And I love a story where you see a team have great team chemistry and everyone doubts them, and then to finally see it kind of click and say, well, that's what happens when players care about each other and care about winning a game for their team. It needs to happen more often, sure, but that's a pretty positive sign. Philadelphia has been a very defensively sound team this season and hasn't given up many goals at all.
Especially at home for Colorado to do that, not only increases the team camaraderie, but increases the bond with their fans.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's a great result there. Other games around the league.
Oh, I was going to say, I have a couple points of that.
Sure, yeah.
Unfortunately, again, I didn't know the result of this game before I saw it, so the first thing I wrote down is, fuck, Andre Blake is so good and we never talk about it. I don't think maybe he was at fault, but it's unfortunate for him that it was a 3-goal game, but I do think he's kind of underappreciated, potentially because of the team that he plays for.
I completely agree. It is unfortunate to see such great players and players that have been around for a while in the league not play for the flashy teams, and then they just get completely overlooked. But you wouldn't think in a 3-0 game you'd say, oh, the opposing goalkeeper or the losing goalkeeper had a great game. But I actually do think he had a great game. He had some great saves. His positioning is so good. And his reflexes are just dynamite, too. I really don't think there was much he could have done about, maybe one of them, but
because the first two are very much like he's in the right position and he takes his chance in the first two.
Yeah.
So to a certain extent, I'd have to go back and look at each of them to say if maybe they could be stoppable. But I mean, like, it was more of a positioning issue, which is not always something that you can deal with.
A goalkeeper has to commit. If your defenders aren't stepping up as a goalkeeper, you need to stand tall, close down space, and commit. And it's basically the only position in the field where you can do that. Is you do have to get stuck in and commit to going one way or the other. You can't afford to just run with the player, and hopefully you make the right call. But again, if you're not being supported by your defenders, then it's easier to get caught out. So I wouldn't even necessarily see those as positioning errors. He's being forced to step up and play the ball because there's no pressure being put on the player.
Yeah.
And as a goalkeeper, eventually you're always the last man back.
That being said, for Badji, as much as those first two were poacher's goals, I think it was nice. It was nice in terms of, like, to actually look at this as a real achievement. That last goal was an excellent shot with a great run that led up to it. So as much as the other two were more opportunistic, which doesn't take anything away from them. But the third one, he got a real scorer's goal and it was great.
Yeah. No, and got to be great for his confidence. And admittedly, when he's taking it on, you're kind of like, oh, just pass, man. Like, you don't need the hat trick. There is a guy wide open. And credit to him for just being calm and going, no, I'm having it. And that's their first hat trick in 7 years. Rapids.
Oh my God! Yes, that the rough times for the Rapids. The club identity is so good that if they were able to put it together a little bit more, they could be a leading club.
Yeah.
We were talking about, you know, the New England play being your play of the week. I'm honestly wondering if the goal of the week is not was not scored by San Jose's defender Tannerholm. In San Jose's 2-1 loss to New York City, because maybe this is just being too crazy contrarian. I liked that game. I don't want to just say that I hated that game. It was very good, exciting. I know I might be just sort of disappointed by the hype, but compared to the half volley that Zlatan hit, defender Anton Tannerholm takes a volley at the top of the box that looked real pretty to my eyes.
Oh shoot!
Oh, that is actually that was a New York player. Sorry.
Yes, I just watched it. Admittedly, this is the one game I paid no attention to because I don't like New York City, and San Jose. I think this match was just at a weird time too, so I missed it, and I somehow missed it in the highlights too. That is
wasn't
a
lot to it.
That is a peach. Wow, that's a hell of a goal.
Yeah, and it's like as much as I know, I said it was the artistry of the Zlatan goal was how made up his mind was, mm-hmm. but because of the length of the half volley bounce, Zlatan was able to really put his stuff together. In Tannerholm, only Tannerholm has the full volley here.
Yeah. No, and another good result for New York City FC. You know, it's funny because I felt like this last season too is they get to be top of the table, and I'm like, wait, what? How? New York City? Are they even that good? Like, I know David Villa scores goals at will. And maybe it's just a bit of a Western Conference bias that I don't always pay attention to the really good Eastern Conference teams. But this is just another example where New York City just racks up the wins. I'd love to see that character result in more in the postseason or sort of heading down the stretch. That they do seem to be so dominant, and they go and they go and they go, and then kind of nothing really seems to come of it. But San Jose, especially considering how good they've been as of late, yeah, darn. I could watch that goal all day. I just watched it like 5 times.
Yeah, go watch it. Anton Tannerholm. I would say when we're talking about poor defense, another issue of this was a corner, that first goal. Quintana just sort of like it was a corner goal. It was a corner kick. Mm-hmm. And Quintana just walked in front of all of the defenders.
Yeah.
And headed in the goal from the near post. Like,
I so just want to talk about a different storyline one week. Well, I guess we didn't have to do it too much last week, but my God, like,
there's a lot of great attacking play. There's a lot of great attacking play.
There's a lot of great attacking play. It's very exciting to watch as a fan.
And this was a different defensive lapse than all the other ones, so that I can also feel good about that.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, it's 1-0 for Chivas at halftime. In CCL action.
Home in Mexico, it's not ideal for New York, but we'll see how things go over the length of the program.
The live updates.
Yes.
Yeah, they did. New York did field their starting 11 that we've familiarly seen many times, so that's interesting.
Let's take a moment then, because of the starting 11 and the CONCACAF issue, to talk about TFC, who finally got their first win of the season, goals of the season, after losing their first two. It looked morose, but that's just because TFC had that game rescheduled, so they had only played two games when. Yep. Like, at points during the weekend, the Whitecaps had played 5 games and TFC had played 2 games.
Yeah.
That's just sort of how that scheduling... So, like, you can't really look at that and learn anything from it.
No.
I think that from the lineups of the 2 games, when you're looking at RSL, it feels like they're the key sort of components of their quote-unquote B team are Hassler, Esteke, mm-hmm. and to St. Ricketts. And I think they perform well in the RSL game. Mm-hmm. Esteke is taken a little bit to warm up, and he had a shot off the crossbar, but I think that more time can only benefit him. And this strategy that they're having where just the early league results are just not even important in the least to a certain degree. No, I mean, it's great for them to get the win, but it's Greg great for Vanney them to have this B team some minutes.
Yeah, and everyone, including us, has talked about Toronto's depth that they've been able to call on at key times. Their stars perform pretty consistently, so they haven't necessarily needed that, except when Giovinco or Altidore have been injured. But I agree, and I think Greg Vanney's smart enough to and calm enough to know that, fuck, whatever, you lose your first 2 games of the season. It's not ideal, but he's patient enough to know that it's MLS. You're going to lose games. No team is going to come in and only lose 3 games in a season. You're going to give up, at the very least, 5, 6, 7 games, and you're just going to have to take it on the chin and learn from it. And this was it was sort of like a, oh yeah, Toronto, like this is what they can look like. The 2 penalties I thought was kind of unfortunate. I thought one of those was a penalty, and one of them to me was sort of like Altidore knows.
I agree.
The first one, actually, I think, is Altidore knows that contact is coming and folds like a lawn chair. But
so the first one. So I thought that the first one was the non-call.
Oh, well, there we go.
let's fight about it.
like what's your MLS
so
fans.
So I kind of think that on that first goal that the guy can't get his arms out of the way. There's no. You can't really, as much as it goes off his arms.
I got them mixed up. Yes.
On that first goal, the collapsing defender can't get his. He's planted on his arm that touches the ball. I think.
Just from
my look at the replay, I don't think that he can get that arm out of the way, and so I don't know that you could really call. It's on him to move his arm, like to try him, like. But I don't think he can move his arm at that point. So I don't. I thought it was a tough penalty call.
I agree, it's a tough penalty call. My issue was the Altidore just collapsing so hard in a heap from the slightest bit of contact behind. The player really doesn't play him. You know, mm-hmm. If you look at the replays, you do see contact. I get the call. But
so that's on the second one, right?
Yeah, the second one. Sorry, but for me, like a player of Altidore's height and stature, and the fact that he's not running full tilt in that moment goes to me. He feels the contact and he falls over. He sells that penalty. I think it's brilliant acting, and him and Giovinco do it constantly throughout the season. But I think it's rough. I will name my bias in that I'm looking for Altidore and Giovinco to hit the deck. But that is also because they do it every single game so consistently. And you know what? If you do it and you fool the referee, then fair enough. You get the penalty. It happens in every league in the world. But I felt like that one was particularly soft and kind of unfortunate as well, because Raimondo has a great stop against the first penalty. And then Altidore sinks the second one.
I love Raimondo. I did have, with that second penalty, again, to be contrarian, I did have written in my notes that it was a lazy foul. Maybe I needed to watch a couple more replays. Maybe there's something I'm missing out of that. But that doesn't mean you're wrong. Like, I do definitely think he sells it. But I thought that kind of the defender could have done a little more to get himself out of that situation.
There's two people in every penalty call. And, well, in MLS, sometimes seven people. if you include fourth officials, etc. But in this one, yeah, I do agree. It is still a lazy foul. So I get what you're saying. And I think I from that point of view, sure, I can say you do kind of have to give the penalty because the foul doesn't look good. And it is kind of lazy. Whether or not he actually really makes much contact or Altidore needs to go down in that moment. I think for me, it's just like, he's a massive player. There's no way a player a foot shorter than him with so much less muscle is really pushing him off the ball that much when he's not clipping his feet. Altidore feels the contact and hits the deck. But if you're the defender, you should know that. Because everybody knows that he's going to do that. Because he does it so frequently. What are you going to do?
I love Nick Raimondo. He's really good. Seeing that penalty save was great. I think that because RSL is in a little bit of a down period, sometimes he doesn't always get the shine he deserves. But and he's also kind of in he's 38. He's in the final years of his career. So I feel like he also is not necessarily at his peak. But he has been a stalwart player in this league, and I loved seeing him stop the penalty against Chivinko.
Yeah, I love seeing him stop any penalty. It's just great that he keeps doing it against Chivinko. Another goalkeeper. I mean, to be a goalkeeper in MLS, I think you have to have ice in your veins to begin with, because you can't always count on your defenders. But it is unfortunate to see a goalkeeper that's so good get caught out. But, you know, Tim Howard, Andre Blake, like, take your pick. I'm kind of looking around the league. We had a couple other games. Atlanta-Minnesota was kind of a non-starter. I mean, it was a win for Atlanta. But my notes on this game was just sort of like, okay, that seems like a result. I was glad that Minnesota got stuck in and didn't make it easy for them. And getting, you know, I think that's a rivalry that's heated up a little bit or has remained from early days last season when Minnesota got properly blown out in early parts of the season. And I'm liking the way Minnesota's looking, but that's about as much as I can say about this match. Is Atlanta looks pretty good, not quite as good as last year. Minnesota looks like a completely different team despite being largely the same team.
Really rough decision-making on the red card by Gonzalez Perez, who it looks like followed through on a play over the end line. Mm-hmm. So, like, minutes, like long after it was aware that there was no reason for him to make contact, he just sort of a soft shoulder check, but late enough that it was considered to be dangerous play.
Yeah,
just because you don't. There's no need. It's not in hockey. You don't need to, you know, hit somebody against the boards.
Well, and I think the thing to be clear about now is, can we not just acknowledge that, okay, we're 5 games in for some teams, but we're 5 weeks in. MLS is cracking down on violent play across the league. So you can argue against it that you don't like it, but they are doing that. So as a player, you have to be able to take that on board and adjust your style of play, not just continually do the same things. And stuff that maybe flies in other leagues is not going to fly in this league. Again, debate it all you want, but we've seen a very clear pattern now in MLS that this is not a... The referees have clearly been told to clamp down on certain things. Touching of the face, for instance. So don't do it. Like, it's not incidental. So I don't really get where players or fans can be surprised when it does happen. You want to see the right decision being made, and you want to see a good game of football. But if you've seen a precedent be established, then I think as coaches and players need to take that on board and adjust accordingly rather than cry foul every single time it happens.
The one thing I wanted to comment on with Minnesota before we moved off of it is that they didn't take advantage of that red card. Mm-hmm. They, for a number of reasons, including 7 minutes of stoppage time, they had a couple of okay chances, including a shot from Sam Nicholson that nobody was around to collect a rebound from. Mm-hmm. But so that's just kind of the issue with that, is that they were in a prime position to get something out of that match and didn't do it. But the next thing I wanted to talk about, since you were mentioning the violent play issue, was the Seattle-Montreal game.
Yeah.
which also featured a red card. Previously we talked about the ball tap. This time we had a butt check from Leerdam, who, in much of the same situation as the Atlanta thing, just didn't need to do that.
Yeah.
There was no need to be in that position where he just backs into a guy and takes him out in a relatively low pressure situation at the halfway line.
And where Seattle has struggled, and I mean, this isn't just a disciplinary thing, but is focus. Like, they seem to be kind of coming apart at the seams. And this was a game where I thought there were spells where you saw what Seattle can do in their pace and their ability to sort of play the tiki-taka football and move the ball around and do quite well, which is funny because I actually thought New England did that as well. Like, New England was moving the ball around at will for parts of their game. But it's a silly foul. It's violent. It's needless. It achieved absolutely nothing and achieved even less by having a player sent off. And it's really hard not to begin to form the narrative that Seattle is just beginning to get frustrated and running a little bit out of ideas. And I think in previous years, we've seen a Seattle that maybe would have responded a little bit differently and come back and tried to score some goals, but they just look kind of neutered for most of this game. And credit to Montreal for pouncing on them and making them pay for it. Also, Piatti is a very good soccer player, as it turns out. And
yeah, it's important to note.
Brilliant vision. That goal was a brilliant tactical team goal. It helps if you have somebody like Piatti on that team.
You think of Piatti as a sort of as a target man himself, mm-hmm. but he was able to blow past a couple of people with some beautiful cutbacks and be the provider to Jason Vargas.
Yeah, which is and is a great bit of vision, and then also a great bit of just getting in the right place. That's what I'm trying to say. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. And this is also, it's important because I think that compared to Toronto, which had also had a 2-0 start to the season, but really seems to kind of have it together. Mm-hmm. Seattle does seem, because we think so much about Seattle and its issues, this is a great result for Montreal.
Yeah.
In what's more of a rebuilding year, in props props to them for re-signing Piatti and for Piatti for staying around in more of a development time. But to go away to Seattle and get a win is great.
Yeah, especially for a team like Montreal. I think it was a good signal of intentions. And I think that they did everything right in that they got the goal and they held on to it. And they just needed to put this one to bed and go home with a road victory to start building up some of that confidence, because they are in a bit of a development phase. And I think that they have a good possibility of making the playoffs. They don't look like a team right now and with the personnel they have that's going to go far. But they're building something that I think it can continue to be really, really great. And sure, Seattle is struggling, but you still have to, they're still a great team, and you still have to go into a very, arguably one of the most hostile environments in MLS, and to scrape out a win there is not a thing a lot of teams do.
It's true.
So in any way, anyhow, I think is probably what they're thinking.
The critique that I would really have in terms of, I think a lot of people have pointed to Jordan Morris being gone. Yeah. But there's a lot of great players, attacking players, that are still there on Seattle, regardless of whether or not Morris is around or Dempsey is available or what have you.
Yeah.
I would say that the biggest issue, the biggest change between last year and this year is the absence of Jovan Jones. Mm-hmm. Calvin Leardom got himself into trouble with that red card. But I also thought that Gustav Svensson, and maybe that's an issue, maybe it's a, if there's an issue with adapting to the red card or an issue with covering somebody who's being in a tougher situation. Svensson also had a lot of problems down that left-hand side.
He sure did. And Lodero had some chances as well, but he's just seemed right-hand to side?
Not sure.
Fallen off considerably. And Lodero is getting into the right spaces and doing a lot of the right things, but just doesn't seem to have that confidence or that final little bit of class and touch that we saw in his first season. And I just wonder how long Seattle can wait for that to switch back on, because we kind of waited and waited and waited last season to see it, and we saw little flashes of brilliance, but it never fully materialized. And now to have a new season and to see him kind of actually performing even lower than he did last season, sure, it's only a few games in, but again, how long do you wait on with a player on that high of salary to perform?
I think a real critique is something that's either proves that it's not his fault or is a total critique of him, is that Will Bruin needs a friend. When Dempsey is there and Bruin doesn't have to be that solo striker, I think he performs a lot better. And the critique where that becomes a critique of Lodero, is that Lodero is so good that I don't know why it should have to be that way, where we're leaving, you know, Bruin up to dry, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. There's just something that's not connecting for them right now.
They're not clicking. I wrote that down. That's absolutely right.
Yeah, and despite when you do watch them, there's lots of points where they look good. They look like a Seattle team that we've seen many, many times. They just can't seem to get the final thing to fall for them. And then heaping on poor decision-making by players and getting sent off is not helping them any. Mm-hmm. Looking elsewhere in the league, Sporting KC, DC United, I feel like is another one we can kind of shrug our shoulders and go, okay, sounds like a fair result. If anything, I'm surprised KC didn't come away with a little bit of a bigger margin there, but a 1-0 victory
KC
seems about right for where they're both at this time in the season.
KCDC.
KCDC.
That was kind of one of my only notes. And also, we were talking about the prevalence of the particular type of own goal that LA Galaxy conceded/scored. We also saw a very similar one in this match.
Yeah, basically that's I think that's all I've got to say about that one.
Rough for David Osted. Only good thoughts for his future matches.
Thoughts and prayers for David Osted.
Chicago, Portland drew 2-2.
Sure did. I was actually surprised by this game. Admittedly, when I was picking my fantasy team, part of me was like, load up on Chicago players because Portland's been so bad. And then for whatever reason at the last minute, I didn't. The result sort of belies the actual game, which I thought was another sort of interesting match. And not completely poor defending. Great to see Diego Valeri sort of come back and do something. And very early on in the 6th minute just decides, fuck it, I'm scoring a goal. We need to score a goal. We need to do something. Scores a goal. And does what Diego Valeri does so often. So that was great.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, Brandon Vincent from Chicago in this game was just so, so good. And I just kept, as I was watching it, I was like, who's Brandon Vincent? Should I know him? Is he new? What's his story? And it was a great sort of clawback from Chicago. And they've not started particularly strong either. But it was great to see them claw something back and show a bit of character. And I thought Schweinsteiger had a brilliant match as well and was defending well, being playmaker, and really seems to understand his role within Chicago Fire. That isn't just about the way that he's been successful at other teams, where he really does have to kind of be all things for all players. But I see him almost kind of relishing that a little bit and getting stuck in challenges where a lot of players his age coming over from Europe would just be like,
yeah,
fuck it. Like, let them have it. And he's going in and lunging in to save the ball that creates the play that scores a goal. Is really, really positive to see that Schweinsteiger is not phoning it in.
I think that we may, as Zlatan scores more, we may compare. That was my first thought, was just because of their similar positions in being injured and out of favor in Manchester United. I think that maybe Schweinsteiger has had to adapt his game a little bit more, but you're absolutely right. He was, maybe I was wrong and it was on the attack, but I had that he was doing basically like center back work.
He was. He was. You
would never expect him out of this kind of a guy.
No. And that's again where I go, like, I don't want to project too much onto the guy because I don't know him and I haven't heard him say this. But to me, you know, he's playing in a team that's struggling, but he's having to play differently. And you've got to think that after being in so many different squads and winning so many things, it's got to be kind of exciting, and he looks like he's enjoying his football. And Schweinsteiger is the kind of player that you want him. Last season he had to do an awful lot of thinking because he was playing with a not terribly great team that didn't really understand how to best support him either. And he even made comments about having to really adjust his style of play because the types of things you can do in Europe and the passes you can kind of make, and you're just expecting players to get on the end of it. In MLS, maybe that's not the case. I'm really excited for a renewed, older Schweinsteiger who, if they can manage his minutes properly, can be a real on-field leader and to every single player on the pitch, not just as a playmaker, but as somebody who's getting in and doing the dirty work at the back and going in for sort of dead balls to rescue something is great initiative. And we know, like, just flick it into the box and Nikolic will be around there somewhere to at least have a crack at it. If that ball is bouncing or dead or just anywhere in and around the penalty box, Nikolic is not far behind and he's usually going to get a boot on it.
Absolutely.
So, interesting
result. I didn't think it said a lot about Portland. Obviously the offense is firing, but
yeah, I think with Portland and Seattle, it's right now it is just a case of it will come together. I don't see them as having terrible seasons. I think they're just off to poor starts. But both teams have shown flashes of what can happen when they are switched on. So
The other thing I had written down is no one can defend in the air. Pretty much everywhere around the league.
Yeah.
If you send a nice cross in, pretty much everywhere. Except
Vancouver Whitecaps.
Yes.
What did you think was going to come out of this game? Before we even talk about the actual game, of course by now people have seen it and know the result, but what did you think was going to happen as a result in this game?
Well, I think that like the LA game, I kind of knew that it was going to be it was a win, although I didn't know what the number was. Watching it, I watched it the next day and while I was doing other stuff. I would say the Whitecaps are still a little bit of a weird unknown to me right now in terms of it being so early in the season that it's like some of the wins, it's not like they felt like fluke wins, but you know, I'm just so used to seeing, you know, shows of offense from the players that we know that can be good. This year, as we've talked about a little bit, he's way more direct than previous years. So, like, to know how that fares everywhere, know how that fares on the road, etc., is a challenge. And they didn't do that great on the road in Atlanta, and Columbus has been firing on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. But I thought they looked great here.
I thought they did, too. And for a team that's looked so good in Columbus... and been good at home as well. I was a little bit nervous about this one. Not because of the Kai Kamara storyline or any of that shit. Just because Columbus has been a great team.
Yes.
And... I wasn't sure how We've been traveling a lot. We're going to continue to travel. The Vancouver Whitecaps have the worst and longest amount to travel in the league this season. By a quite large margin, if I'm recalling correctly. But it was interesting because it's a 2-1 result. The Zardes goal to me, it was just a bit unfortunate. You know, Marinovic gets there and just spills it in front. And no one's really marking him. He's allowed to drift in a little bit. But I think the way that they were playing was essentially 4 at the back, but at times it was sort of turning into 3. To try to catch Columbus on the counter, which I don't think was the wrong decision to make. It just meant that they were punished relatively early on into the match for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is that first goal, right?
Yeah.
The defense was... I have written down that the defense was incredibly nowhere. Which, I mean, like, this is what we've been talking about in terms of Zardes turning himself around, being able to take advantage of these opportunities when they are presented to him. Mm-hmm. Which was great for him. It must be tough for the great year that Columbus has had, especially at home. But I thought it was a great sort of recovery on the road from Vancouver. I mean, like, we don't talk about the city more, but I just remember back to the times when Vancouver was garbage on the road.
That was only 3 years ago. It's really been only the last 2 years that they've been good on the road.
Under the same manager, so it's a credit to Carl Robinson that that's been the case. That turnaround has happened. I thought that the Breck Shea goal, the positioning and the finish was great from Shea, but I also want to give a little shout out to the power on the shot across that got deflected.
Yeah.
There was gas on it. What happened with this disallowed Davies goal? People think it bounced off his hand?
Yeah. So I was watching it and I was very excited and it looked like a clean goal. And then they show the replay and basically the ball skips up off the turf in the penalty area and hits Davies' hand. Now Davies is trying to pull his arms back and the ball just skips up and hits him in the hand and then he scores the goal. Super frustrating, and I get it. And I know there's the debate about is it ball to hand or hand to ball. I think that there's a safe enough argument to be made here. Like, it skips up and hits his hand and I do see him pulling his arm back, but it comes off his hand and lands directly at his feet in prime position. I don't think it's intentional. I do think it's a handball. I do think the goal should have been disallowed. It's very hard to admit as a fan, but I think if we're going to be fair and we want to see calls in the league improve, we can't just cry wolf at every single tiny little thing. Of course, it's going to be incredibly unpopular to say that Alfonso Davies doesn't get a goal. We want him to get a goal. It's a brilliant bit of play from him. It's unfortunate that the ball comes up and hits his hand. But the way that it does, whether it's ball to hand and not hand to ball, it puts the ball directly in his path, on his feet, and he scores the goal. You have to call that kind of thing, because if you don't, then you're opening yourself up to all kinds of situations in which then people are going to say, well, how come that wasn't a handball? There's enough doubt in there that the goal should have been disallowed. That being said, that's much easier to say, because not long after that, Kai Kamara comes in with a very similar type of play and just buries it and gets his goal that really did sort of feel special and quite appropriate, given it's his first trip back to Columbus. But overall, I thought it was a nervy at times performance from the Whitecaps. But as my mom said, who I was watching the match with, Columbus is really good and they played really well. So it wasn't nervy particularly because the Caps were playing poorly, but because, as my mother pointed out, Columbus Crew is a great team and they played really well.
I was worried because Columbus fans, we love you. We know, you know, we love you. Hashtag save the crew. We talked about it. And there were some points where I saw some people complaining about somebody diving. I want to say it was Aja.
Aha.
Aha. I just think of the Steely Dan album, Aja, that is spelled A-J-A as well. It might have been Aha that I saw. I saw some complaints online, and I was like, no, let's still be friends.
I know. Well, and then there's some video circulating from the supporter section of the crew when Kai Kamara came up to the supporter section. And, I mean, okay, he did his goal celebration, the heart-shaped hands thing, but it's also, like, for his foundation. He does it after every single goal. I believe he was trying to, like, show some respect to the home supporters, and they were not happy about it at all. And, you know, whatever. Again, I think home supporters should to get in to the away team whenever they can, and it's certainly a popular player to hate, but I thought it was a little bit like, I don't think he's trying to agitate the crowd. I think he's trying to pay his respects, but I think it's also okay that you're booing them. I don't know.
I'm just saying, let's still be friends.
I almost got into a Twitter fight with another Vancouver soccer podcast because they were going after Save the Crew for not getting back to them fast enough because they wanted to do an interview. And they're like, this isn't helping their cause. I was prepared to put my relationship with local fans on the line for Save the Crew fans, because I was like, no, guys, we have to be friends. We have to get along. We're all in this together. Luckily, it didn't amount to much, but I was sort of like, no, no.
That was the most that I had on that one. The attendance was pretty normal with Seattle and StubHub Center, because that's still happening for some reason, being the only NFL stadiums in play, to my knowledge. Seattle was tops of the week with 39,469. Columbus lowest with 8,992, which is actually a little bit worrying, but...
Yeah, that's... The one thing I will say, and I think this is fair, and some of the Save the Crew people have said it, is if your ownership is so hell-bent on selling your team and moving out of your city, there's not really a lot of incentive for people to come and buy tickets.
And... Every single person that's there, and this is, I know I say it's worrying, and I don't want to be critical. Every single person that's there is, like, doing it in fucking defiance of what the team is trying to get them to do.
Yeah, totally. And it would be amazing. It would be amazing if you could get all of a sudden 15, 16,000 people in record crowds. I don't think it's going to happen. And I do think part of it is the ownership's decisions and really poor communication off the field. But I agree, worrying, but I think the assessment of just like, hey guys, if you cared about your team, you'd fill a stadium, of like, fuck man, if they said the Whitecaps were moving to San Antonio next week, you think there'd be 26,000 fans in the stands? There's not a chance. Like, that's just the reality of sports.
The other thing that I would say I was a little worried about is Colorado 10,790. Eesh.
Yeah, and watching that match too is like, it looks real bad. And I don't want the attendance to be the only thing, and I don't want us to become a podcast about key business indicators. But it is a little bit worrying, and I don't think you need to look to Atlanta or Seattle to be the norm. But hopefully you would expect some growth, if not at least being able to fill your stadium 2/3. But for the Houston, the Colorados, the Columbuses of the league, it is a little troubling when there's so much trouble getting people to come in and pay money to see the match.
It's just the difference. It's just this weird difference now that the league has evolved and evolved and evolved again. They haven't been able to do it for everybody, but they're not... The promotion, it's always the promotion is always whatever the new discovery is, whatever the new player is, whatever the new stadium you can fill is.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily rising all boats.
No, and like Chivas USA was a new team. So, like, can happen to anyone. And that's the thing, I guess, to think about is if we want to take a step back and look at the context of it is 5 years from now, 10 years from now, but even 5 years from now, let's say, you know, Carlos Vela's, he leaves, does his bit there. LAFC tries to build up its youth squad. It doesn't pay off. And the rest of MLS teams continue to get better. They've got a brand new expensive stadium to fill. You know, I mean, in some ways they're caught in a bit of a trap because they've got to pay for that. But, you know, it's easy to like the flashy new thing and rally behind it. And just moving teams around is not always the best way of doing it. But as we've seen in North American sports, that is the norm. It happens in hockey. It happens in basketball. It happens now in MLS. It's an unfortunate reality, and I hope it can be staved off somewhat. But... Don Garber certainly has seemed to be he's all about flavor of the week and not for longevity, so we'll see what happens.
Elsewhere around North America, former Whitecaps defender David Edgar has landed with FC Nashville.
Nice.
So yeah. Great congratulations to him. It's great to see him find a job or find a location. The New York, the three NASL teams, the New York Cosmos, I want to say the Jacksonville team and the Tampa Bay Rowdies have been given dispensation to enter their B-sides into the U.S. Open Cup, which did kind of, that's what they're doing this year after the NASL suspended operations. Those three clubs are running basically just their reserve teams in the NPSL. They had to do an appeal because they had originally been barred from the U.S. Open Cup on the basis that the NPSL teams had not previously existed. Mm. And there, despite the fact that, you know, the Cosmos were in the NASL championship, that it didn't count. To which the Cosmos said, well, the LAFC also didn't have a league result last year, and it's in the U.S. Open Cup, and pointed to other USL and MLS teams that are entering their secondary teams in the U.S. Open Cup, which I don't think is great as well. But this is sort of the next step in sort of the evolution of what's going on in that second division situation in their conflict with U.S. soccer. They didn't get the injunction, but this is kind of another feather in their cap in terms of ways in which they say they've been put upon by the U.S. Soccer Association for being the NASL. One other piece of controversy has to do with FC Cincinnati, which we usually quite enjoy, and another former Whitecap in Tommy Heinemann.
Yeah.
The Major League Soccer Players Association has gone in hard on this USL team for releasing Heinemann. The USL team says he failed a physical. the union says he's healthy, and they never tested him before signing him to a contract. It's a tough situation. I don't even know that it is. Basically, the union's position is, you signed to this contract, and here we are.
Yeah, and I think they're right in calling foul on that. I mean, players' associations exist for a reason, to protect players who are in pretty vulnerable places. And there ain't a lot of money in USL, so this is somebody's livelihood, and if you're violating a contract, you deserve to be held to account for it. And it certainly, at least from initial reports, it sounds a little fishy. And just not in good faith. You know, I struggled even with the David Edgar thing of, I get it, you know. You want to have fit players on your team and I think it's right that they give you a chance and they help you recover, but it is always rough to see a player that just because of injury, now you're kind of just like, oh, well, let's just cut them loose.
And it sucks. Apparently the USL ordered them, sort of ruled in Heinemann's favor, and then they took it to arbitration, so they kind of had to find other things to do in the meantime. I think the interesting thing to watch with this in the future is why it was the MLS Players Association, of which Heinemann is a former member. I think have specifically invoked the fact that Cincinnati is a prospective MLS ownership group.
Mm-hmm.
As sort of like, this is a warning shot situation for two organizations that as of yet don't have a stakeholder relationship, mm-hmm. but may do soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I was remembering I ran into Tommy Heinemann once on Granville Island, and he was buying flowers with his girlfriend. And I tweeted at him, and I was like, hey, I saw you. And he's like, you should have said hi. And I was like, all right. And then last year I found out he was a Trump supporter. So, but Heinemann still shouldn't have his contract violated.
Oh, no.
But, well, I don't know. Is that the wrong thing to bring up?
The only last thing that I had on my docket is we've got a new piece by Tom Dart in The Guardian titled MLS's Turf Problem. Can a league be world-class on artificial grass? Now that Zlatan is here.
The old perennial topic.
The little rubber pellets are causing trouble again. It's just sort of speculating on what's going to happen now Zlatan's here with artificial turf, because Henry famously only played one game in the playoffs on that kind of a surface.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to see the list. Atlanta, Minnesota, Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, and New England are the teams that play on artificial surfaces. Do you think that this is going to be very obvious when Zlatan plays? Is Zlatan the other thing too? Is does it become a competitive imbalance issue? Like we see in England, we see teams, sort of get fined for not playing players in the League Cup in their league system. If you are Vancouver and you, we still don't know what's going to happen with Zlatan in artificial turf, but if having artificial turf means you're never going to see Zlatan at home.
It's difficult. First of all, fuck this topic. But if I have to respond, that's not against you. That's just against how every year some British journalist brings this up. There are so many shit pitches around England that are constantly under scrutiny, and yet somehow that's just like an acceptable but it's just part of the romance of the game. I can't remember, was it Coventry recently where they had to play a League Cup game and their pitch was just an absolute fucking disaster and had potholes everywhere and they had to go in and try to fix it, otherwise the league was going to move the cup. I should have looked up the name because maybe it wasn't Coventry and I don't want to throw anyone under the bus here. But
which team are you talking about specifically?
In England. It was an English team. I don't remember the team. But their real pitch was so real bad that, and they had to play.
Well, this is one thing that was good about the article. As much as, like, you know, you read the headline and you're not as into it, and it doesn't really come into, it doesn't really come in until you get to paragraph like 14 or so. But the piece does make the good point that Houston's real pitch at the BBVA Compass Stadium is garbage.
Yeah, to me, this is clickbait. It's not. It's worth discussing insofar as we know it has had real effects in the past. The way that it affected Henri, I don't think will matter as much. It won't be the same reasons for Ibrahimovic. But the dude has a repaired ACL. And you have to watch players like that anyway, on any pitch. But increasingly, like, Atlanta plays on an artificial pitch. They pull in 75,000 fans. Lots of teams go there. It looks like a fantastic pitch. To my knowledge, no players have complained about the quality of the pitch. The technology has improved. The quality of players in the league has improved. It's a reality of our league. So whether it's right or it's wrong is kind of irrelevant, because nobody's going to rip up their fucking artificial turfs and put in real grass. If Vancouver wasn't going to do it for the World Cup, they ain't going to do it for league play. And I don't think any of the other teams with artificial turf are going to do it either. DC United played in like a children's parking lot a week ago on real turf. Like,
I think
we're looking at the wrong angle to this issue here.
I think that there's also kind of another, it's not the same, like, you know, two types of MLS as we were talking about with the financial issue.
Yeah.
But MLS is such a varied league geographically that you have teams like Houston that have extreme adverse hot weather effects that affect a pitch. And on the other hand, you have teams like New England and Toronto where, I mean, Toronto's pitch is not that bad. But, like, you know, I totally get why New England is on, aside from the ground share, I totally get why New England is in that situation.
How is Colorado not on an artificial pitch? Can you imagine playing on that pitch? Or RSL, for that matter? Basically playing up in the sky?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, I don't know. I've only ever played competitively, if you can call that, in bottom division urban rec soccer on artificial turf, and they've gotten better, and the pitches that they're building have gotten better. It's interesting that the Whitecaps training facility is real grass and is a beautiful 2 official length size pitches on real grass. But they also have a training ground right beside it that's artificial turf, and they've done away with the little rubber pellets because of carcinogens in them, and it's sort of recycled little green pellets now. And I gotta say, it's amazing to play on, and if you maintain it well, it's great. And especially with some of the technology now, the ball doesn't bounce in such weird ways either. Nor, if you go down, is it quite so jarring to the system. I do think it matters, but the reality is it's not going to change in MLS. So will it matter for players like Ibrahimovic? Probably. Is that reason enough to go change a bunch of, spend tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars putting real grass in stadiums? It's just not going to happen, plain and simple. So,
we'll see how it goes.
We'll see how it goes. Real grass is great to play on, but I think there's a case to be made for high-quality artificial turf pitches, and MLS is not alone in this. So I think that's the other thing is, for a while, yet Europeans are going to continue to look down their nose at MLS and think of it as a retirement league, think of it as, you know, we're playing on plastic pitches and all of that, and I'm okay with that. I'm quite okay with that. But the reality is we're not the only league that has that by far. And as the pitches get better, I envision, you know, and again, 5 years out from now, we'll be talking about the shitty real pitches in England and in South America, as is already happening, and why they don't have better maintained pitches, which is often artificial.
I think the great point that you made a few times is that it really is down to, especially in MLS, it's down to the maintenance of the pitch and how long the pitch has been out there, what else the pitch is being used for. There's a big real or in terms of real or fake pitches. Now, the one thing that I also look at is that the more I know people weren't sure one way or the other how they felt about the lawsuit during the Women's World Cup about grass pitches in BC Place and other Canadian venues. Mm-hmm. But and I think that there were some people that were doubting the argument that like women's soccer is being disadvantaged because men's soccer would never accept this. Mm-hmm. It's being proved right more every day. I feel to a certain degree. The more that all of a sudden people's minds change when Real Madrid comes to town, or when Zlatan comes to town, or when the World Cup is in the same venue, literally won't accept the same pitch.
Yeah. No, and I don't want to come across sounding like I'm arguing for artificial turf over real pitches. I think that argument holds. And there's definitely a disparity there.
That makes sense.
As we wrap up here, we are in the third minute of added time for Chivas Guadalajara against New York Red Bulls. And this might
be... Love how this comes together.
Might be just shocking to you, but Aurelien Collin has been sent off yet again. It still stays 1-0, so it looks like New York Red Bulls are out of this one.
Well, I mean, the thing is, and this is the thing with the Toronto one, too. It's unfortunate that they don't have the away goal, that New York does not have the away goal. But always grade the curve based on whether, in these at this level, based on whether or not the Mexican team is playing at home.
Yes. 3-1. Looking at the stats, it ain't good. 37% possession from New York Red Bulls. And in terms of just about all the important bits, like shots and creating chances, it's pretty much been all Guadalajara.
Well, maybe they can turn it around. What was TFC's record against Chivas USA? reuniting the great rivalry.
Oh, yeah, it's monkey business with these teams, man. It's crazy. CCL, I cared so much last year, and now I'm just like, oh, I don't even know. Seems to be an awful lot of falling down and fighting. I do love...
I think Canada can be big.
Yeah, I do love Mexican soccer, but I do find it kind of funny that, like, there was complaints about... it was against Giovinco, but complaints against Toronto for diving to win the penalty. And I was like,
Whoa. Have you watched a CONCACAF game?
Oh, yeah. No, it looks like a dive, but it's like, you know, anytime I watch a MX game, I say like players mostly on their bellies, looking like they're swimming rather than playing. So I was just like, oh, okay, sure. And
I would know.
Atletica's coach too, or America's coach too, is just like such a piece of work.
We may be coming towards the end here, but the one thing I forgot to mention during the original talk about the CCL is that I feel like Giovinco has had a tougher time of it in the league so far this year. But he is really, his quality is really shining through at this level that you can still maybe say is arguably a little bit higher than MLS.
Yeah, I agree. And that can happen, right? Is your best players perform best when they have better competition. And that could perhaps explain some of Toronto's struggles right now, is they just haven't faced a really great side and haven't had to dig deeper or dig in much except in CONCACAF. So that could be part of it, is once they start playing some good opponents, we'll see better results from them. And certainly that seemed to be the case against RSL.
Mm. In the meantime, where can we find you online?
You can find me online at That's So MLS on Twitter, trying to politely start fights with other Vancouver-based football podcasts. Where can we find you online?
You can find me online at Team Bates, www.team-bates.com. I am an editor for Howler Magazine, whatHowler.com. You can find this podcast at thatsomls.com and on iTunes. And please give us a rate, review, and subscribe.
Yeah, and also shout out to the Turkish fans. I know a lot of them were here for the Come to Besiktas episode.
But they came to us!
They came to us! Come to That's So MLS, Besiktas. We're here for you. So we do appreciate the folks that are listening as well and subscribing and have already done all the stuff that we've asked you to do.
Somebody apparently edited Kyle Laren's Wikipedia page to say that he has a job as a workout trainer on the sideline at Besiktas.
I love it. well, until next time, sir. Don't get sent off.
Don't get sent off.
Don't slap a person in the face. And don't don't butt check them. And don't hit them in the nuts. There's so many things you can't do in this league. It's all rules.